is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We package all that into a quote-unquote TV game that's then pushed to all of our platforms. We're in 2 billion homes worldwide on Roku, Amazon Fire, YouTube, and then also have apps at your app store. If you search PBA TV, all spelled together, five letters, PBA TV, iOS, Android, just go to your app store and you're able to watch TV games anywhere from your big screen to your laptop to a mobile device, anywhere in the world of every PBA game played.
Chris Terrell has been the commissioner of the Pro Basketball Association since November of 2020. Terrell was the first American to coach at the top pro level on four continents while still in his 30s. He spent over 20 years in the pro game and in that time learned how to win on and off the court. Chris has had the opportunity to coach in the top leagues in China, Romania, Canada, and Mexico. He's also coached in just about every minor league or domestic-based pro basketball league you can think of, including the NBA's D-League, the Basketball League, Maximum Basketball League, and the American Basketball Association. He also served as deputy commissioner of the World Basketball Association. Chris has written for Better Basketball Magazine and for the Eurobasket Network, including U.S. Basket and Latin Basket, for the last 17 years. Hey, Hoopheads, sign up today for the Summer of Better virtual basketball camp with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. And remember, you can get up to $2,000 off on any trade-in. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Todd Kowalczyk, head basketball coach at the University of Toledo. You're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly. Mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, FastModel is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. FastModel also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. FastModel Sports is the best in basketball. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Chris Terrell, Commissioner of the Pro Basketball Association. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel this morning, but I am pleased to be joined for the second time by the Commissioner of the Professional Basketball Association, Chris Terrell. Chris, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
Great. Welcome back. Glad to have you on for a second time. Got some interesting things going on in your career at this point. You've taken on a pretty ambitious undertaking, which we're going to dive into here in a second. But we thought we'd go back and, for maybe people who haven't listened to your first episode, just give people a quick synopsis kind of your background in the game of basketball, where you're coming from, and then we're going to dive into the exciting things that you have going with the PBA.
Yeah. So I started at the high school level. I was actually coaching AAU at a local youth and recreation center in the San Fernando Valley, just outside of Los Angeles. And late 90s, early 2000s, began coaching high school basketball and got the opportunity to be an assistant at the junior college level. And then I got a job in Texas, where I've been ever since. Eventually kind of moved on to minor league basketball, coached in the ABA, took a team to the championship in 2005 called the Texas Tycoons, played in the championship game and lost, but great season, 28-5, and traveled the whole country and got a chance to really know, you know, minor league basketball. But after that, coached overseas for 15 years, top league in China and the CBA. We had two first round NBA draft picks making $60,000 a month. It was just an amazing experience. Got an invitation to NBA summer leagues with the Atlanta Hawks. Was a deputy commissioner in the World Basketball Association. Coached 6 years in Latin America. LNBP and CBA Copa are the two top leagues there. FIBA Europe, first division, a couple seasons. Doing that, went to the Cup quarterfinals when I was in Europe, and coaching Canada, director of basketball operations in the NBA D League. Just, 20 years of bouncing from country to country, and it was an incredible experience.
So you've been involved, obviously, at all different levels of the game, as we just heard. What made you decide, hey, I think now might be the right time for me to jump in and start my own thing and kind of get this professional basketball association up and running? What was the process? Who were the people that you had to talk to first to kind of bounce ideas off of, or how did you assemble your team? Just try to give us the origin story.
Yeah, so it really was born out of a lifetime of frustrations. I would come home every summer. You leave your wife and kids for 8 months and, you know, spend Christmas on Skype opening, you know, presents virtually. And you come home, March, April every year. And, you know, there's pro-ams and money tournaments and summer leagues and different things. And so, you know, I was able to, over the years, kind of keep in contact with a lot of players. Scouting's obviously a key aspect of that, and I would go to, you know, Vegas for the summer leagues every year, but developed a lot of relationships with players. I'm in the Dallas area here, and guys I had either coached before or, you know, later on in my career I coached, you know, their big brothers or their fathers in some cases, you know, or uncles. And it was, you know, really just a frustration with minor league basketball in the United States. Other than, you know, the NBA and the NBA G League, obviously both, you know, funded by the NBA, every level of pro basketball beneath that had its own set of issues. A lot of them, let me say it like this. So I would find players that were really terrific players that I knew were capable, guys that I knew, because I'd see them in the money tournaments or the pro-ams or in the summer leagues, and I'd see them go against, guys that were either in the NBA or guys that were playing in high level, you know, positions in Europe or overseas, and know that they were good enough. But when I would take those players and their resumes back to the powers that be overseas to try and get them signed on my team and or, you know, other general managers or head coaches teams that I'd met over the years, I kind of ran into the same stumbling block. You know, you hit your head in the same place many times, and eventually you want to try and avoid that place. But the issue kind of all went back to the same thing. And that was that minor league basketball in the United States wasn't organized enough to keep complete 16 category box scores for all the games played. League websites didn't accurately depict standings or upcoming games or previous opponents, player profiles, detailed statistics from each one of the games played. Full game video was difficult to come by. And a lot of the numbers, you know, the metrics that the overseas clubs would base their decisions off of were just not captured at the minor league level in the United States. A lot of it was just kind of made up. And it's a real problem in the industry. And, you know, it took me years of kind of getting to the place where I wanted to do something about it. But I'd been putting the pieces in place to address that for a long time. And so finally did with the PBA.
PBA plays a fall winter season beginning in November. Regular season is November, December, January, and February with playoffs in March. So 4 month regular season plus playoffs. And then our spring summer season starts in May, June, July, August with playoffs in September. So 5 months, break for a month, 5 months, break for a month is the way we're set up timeline wise.
All right, let's talk about a couple different aspects of what you just discussed in terms of improvements that you want to make. So let's start with the statistical side. And you mentioned that in a lot of minor leagues, you have this is sort of ramshackle. You're not really putting together and keeping track of the statistics. So how did you go about putting together the team, the system, in order for you to be able to track and get the statistics that you wanted that would enable your players to be able to get some of those bigger deals, whether it was getting signed in the G League or getting a chance to go overseas? How did you go ahead and put that team together to be able to capture the statistics that you needed?
Yeah, great question. So, and you know, most people that, you know, coach at different levels don't really understand why that would be so difficult. And it really kind of comes down to finances. The minor leagues that aren't supported by the NBA in a lot of instances are organizations that kind of leave it up to the teams to do what they do and how they run their organizations. And even for those good teams that, you know, did have statisticians at the table and keeping track of everything that was needed for the game, recording all the games, they still didn't have that uniformity throughout the league where everybody did. So even, you know, you might have all the right information for your home games, but when you went on the road, you weren't getting that information from those teams. And, right. And it just wasn't organized at the league level. And then all that information wasn't, you know, kept on the league website. And I don't want to disparage any leagues or, you know, kind of throw anyone under the bus, but that pretty much is all of them. Unfortunately, there's one other league that I know of that does a better job of that. And I'm referring to the national leagues. But yeah, so what the PBA did that is different than everyone else is we contractually made it a requirement for all teams to record their games. We did flyers, which were, you know, basically just, you know, graphic artwork depicting where the videographer needs to be positioned, what the distance is from the court, the elevation above the court, equidistant from each basket, follow the ball, upload a link to YouTube. And then nationally, we're able to get those game videos from every game played nationwide. And then we have a room full of statisticians. There's, I want to say we're somewhere in the high 30s, 35 to 40 statisticians that then it takes two per game to sit down there, pause, play, and rewind to capture all 16 categories. So field goal attempts made, three-point attempts made, free throws attempts made, assists, steals, turnovers, blocks, and then all the percentages and ratios that, you know, assist to turnover ratio, field goal percentage, three-point percentage, the basic stuff that, and maybe I'm stating the obvious, but if you're a team overseas and you're going to spend, I don't know, $3,000 to fly someone to your country and to get a FIBA license and to house them and, you know, feed them and then go through a training camp and commit to a salary. It's a lot of money by the time you're all said and done, maybe $6,000-$7,000 until you get to the place where you learn whether or not the player you've signed is actually at the level that you need them to be. And so, you know, highlight video showing a guy, everybody makes all their shots in their highlight videos. What they want to see is over the course of an entire season, you know, 16 games played, what the percentages are and the ratios, so they can really get a better feel for, okay, I know I've seen a game of, you know, you making every shot, but what can you consistently do out over the course of the season? And then also, and maybe I'm drilling down a little too far here, but rosters and player profile information, so that I can now gauge what the level is of the players that you're doing it against, and where did they go to college? Where have they played professionally? Have they been overseas? So that once I've got a feel for what their level of play is, then I know what your percentages and ratios mean compared to them, you know, playing against them. And so the statisticians that we have, because we're able to do it from the video, and it's a remote process, it helps scalability. It helps keep costs down, and it allows us to manage that for the league. We report all 16 categories to Eurobasket. And the other thing that we do that's a little bit different is that we have a video editor that has a graphics package. There's a splash video for the PBA. Commercials that are inserted during the games, a score and time widget with the logos of the teams that's displayed on the screen, so that you know what the score is and the time remaining per quarter, and then a play-by-play person. We've got a room of, you know, play-by-play guys that are able to call the game. They're supplied the rosters from both teams, and so that video is then overlaid by an audio file that is the, you know, commentary for the game. And so you actually hear the player's name said, you know, each time they're involved in a play. We package all that into a quote unquote TV game that's then pushed to all of our platforms. We're in 2 billion homes worldwide on Roku, Amazon Fire, YouTube, and then also have apps at your app store. If you search PBA TV, all spelled together, five letters, PBA TV, iOS, Android, just go to your app store and you're able to watch TV games anywhere from your big screen to your laptop to a mobile device, anywhere in the world of every PBA game played.
So that's pretty cool on both levels. On the statistical side of it, being able to have guys sitting in a room remotely and doing the statistics, obviously you can go back and look at it very carefully, as opposed to having each local market have to find people to show up and sit at the scores table. I'm sure it's much easier, as you said, to be able to scale that. And then on the media side, are those games are then broadcast, they're delayed, correct? They're not being broadcast live, if I'm hearing your description correctly.
Yeah, that was another thing that we realized, is that there were a lot of teams at the minor league level that were live streaming, but, you know, 8 o'clock in Los Angeles, 8 p.m. in Los Angeles is, I don't even know what time that is. In France, that's probably 5 a.m.
Right.
You know, the world with time zones, we're all available at different times. And, you know, the live streams can be buffering. They can be jumpy. They sometimes don't have the score and time widget. Maybe you don't have the play-by-play commentary. And, you know, I guess the point could be made that, you know, you could do a professionally done live broadcast of a game, like the NBA as an example, but then you're bringing out television trucks and you got a production team and you need to be able to, you know, stream all of that. You have your own, you know, internet capabilities, so you're not affected by limited bandwidth or shared bandwidth inside of a facility, and scaling that nationwide with the inherent costs in doing that make all for a financial puzzle that's difficult for teams to be able to work with. But the way that we do it, it's all post-production, to your point. Typically in 3 to 4 days, we have the game on TV, and the owners around the league, you know, like that. Nobody's, you know, staying home to watch the game on TV. If they want to see it live, they've got to, you know, go buy tickets to the game. You know, on the back end, we're able to put out a product that's professionally done, that players are able to, and coaches have team meetings and get together, scout future opponents, be able to see what the games played by the other teams in their division, self-scout, watch their own games, kind of have teaching moments where they're able to talk about, okay, this is the way we defended this, and this is what I need you to do different. And then, you know, maybe think about this on that play. And so they're able to walk through that with their own players. It just takes the whole league to another level, I think.
And I would think that, as you talked about earlier, that for teams that are scouting your players, it's a much better situation to be able to have that game available on demand at a higher level of video quality, as you said, with your announcing team in place and the widgets so you can see time and score and all those things, as opposed to the buffering and it's coming out at who knows what time. I think it's more important, right, from a scouting standpoint for the quality of what those overseas teams or what a G League team might see if they're trying to look at a player. I would think that would be a huge selling point for you as you're trying to attract players as well, that, hey, we have this video capability that we're going to be able to get your games to the people that need to see them in order to help you to get another contract.
Yeah. And, you know, it's in a Netflix style video on demand on Roku and Amazon Fire. And so, you know, most smart TVs in 2022 have, you know, access to apps and are able to, you know, watch the games on their big screen TV and, you know, comfort of your own home, pause, play, rewind, sitting on the couch, you're able to, you know, really look at these players, determine, you know, who it is that you like or who you want to, you know, look into a little bit further. And then when you couple that with all the box scores, all the data and metrics from the entire season, access to their player profiles, be able to research who they are, where they went to college, what professional experience they've previously had, learn who some of the other players we talked about earlier that they're competing against so that you can kind of get a better feel for what the overall level is. It really makes for a nice scouting process. You could, you know, stop the game at any time and make your notes and go do what you got to do and come back and pick up later on. And so those are all things that, you know, our system allows.
Putting together this system, obviously for you, part of what you had to do was put together a team of people in order to make this work. So talk a little bit about your process for how you got in connection with the people who are a part of your team that have helped you to put the PBA together. Maybe give a little bit of a bio on each of the people that you have that have been important in your development of the PBA.
Yeah, Curtis Green Richards is the president of 1891. They're basically a tech company. And Curtis had come to me with the idea of putting videographers in all of our gyms, you know, nationwide and recording the games. And we started doing early on in the process, I'm going back to late 2020, the score and time widget and, you know, keeping track of that. But that was done by the videographer in the gym. And then as we evolved, it didn't take long, you know, a month or two later, we were hiring play-by-play guys to do a game of the week. And so that's how we started with the PBA in the first season. We're going into season number three now, but in our first year, it was one game a week nationwide that we picked out as a big game. And we would hire a play-by-play person, give them the rosters for the two teams, give them, you know, a lot of the data and background about the players. And once we did that for the remainder of the season and really kind of started working out the kinks, we evolved to teams hiring their own videographers. And that process that I, you know, described a minute ago, where they provide that video link within 24 hours of the game. But we do the stats and the play by play and everything from that. So Curtis has been, you know, instrumental. We've each step of the way kind of notched up, you know, what we wanted in a PBA experience. You know, he's been instrumental in all of that. And 1891 has an extensive staff now that they've built that we've partnered with that helps us, you know, do that nationwide for every game played now. Every game is a TV game. So Curtis has been a huge part of this whole process. And then Angela Culliver, she's a team owner that came from another league called the ABA that just, you know, kind of was working with us and talking to us about playing in the summer. Originally, we were a spring summer league and the ABA was a fall winter league. And once she got involved and we put her, you know, pretty quickly into a regional manager position because Angela demonstrated communication skills and networking. And she has a military background, served in the Army. She's very task oriented and she was able to lead. And so as she, you know, demonstrated those abilities, we saw the asset that she was to the league. And she went from a regional director position to a national director position. So now she's over all the regional directors nationwide and on a day to day, just helping us, you know, get everything done. She's a huge part of what we do. And then Gary Dotson, he's with the junior NBA. Gary also runs one of the biggest money tournaments every year called the FedEx in Texas. He has a pretty extensive contact list of referees nationwide. And so that's another aspect to the league management that's super important. So, you know, Gary came on with us as our national director of officiating, and he works with assigners all around the country to get, you know, referees out to our games. So I don't want to leave anybody out. There's so many people that are super important to what the PBA does on a day-to-day basis. But those three specifically, you know, are really involved in a national level and help us, you know, do what we do.
So as you're starting to put together your list of cities, franchises, what's the process for putting a franchise in a particular market? How do you go about letting people know that, hey, this is a place that we want to expand? Or are you talking to individuals first, cities first? How does the process work of getting a franchise up and running in the PBA?
Yeah, kind of a crazy story. And so maybe, you know, you and the listeners will get a kick out of this. But, you know, we started in the very beginning. I'm in the Dallas area. And, you know, the idea was that there were some semi-pro teams here in the area that we wanted to join a league together spring, summer. We basically play our first season from, you know, May until August with playoffs in September. And initially, it started with four teams here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And, you know, I think because we, the way we did the website and the way that we were doing our marketing and, you know, me from, you know, maybe having coached, you know, over a couple decades and, you know, kind of social media, a lot of, you know, players and coaches and managers and overseas people that were interested in what we were posting about, it just kind of caught fire in a good way. Here's the funny part. I got a call from a team that was the six-time champion in the league called the PBL, the Premier Basketball League. They're around the Great Lakes, Midwest, and Northeast. And Jen, it was the owner of the Rochester Razor Sharks. She also had won a championship in the ABA prior to joining the PBL. And so, you know, 7-8 year running organization that had saw us on social media, kind of went on the website, kind of found out what we were all about, how we were different. From the very beginning, it was made kind of a point of emphasis that we're going to record all the games. We're going to have detailed box scores for every game played. We're going to partner with Eurobasket. We had a certain, you know, kind of uniformity set rules and standards. Curtis, let me add this part. I probably should have mentioned it earlier when we were talking about him, but I'll bring it up now. Curtis from 1891 is an upper executive with Chick-fil-A. So those of you that are, you know, familiar with Chick-fil-A, it's an organization that has uniformity and standards and kind of a set way of doing things. They've got, you know, a stepped program and a model of what a franchise looks like. And so that kind of drove the conversation early on about how we were going to scale this. But going back to Jen, we didn't have any teams within, this is the funny part, within 2,000 miles of Rochester, New York. We had four teams in, you know, the greater Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I remember getting on the Zoom with, you know, the people that we were working up with, those four other teams, and talking about bringing on this new franchise, and they're like, Chris, what are you doing? You're crazy. Who are they going to play? How is this going to work? And we were, I don't know, maybe 2.5-3 weeks after an announcement that this new league had come about. And here I was wanting to add a team. As it turns out, in Rochester and Buffalo, she wanted to have two franchises in the PBA that first season. And everyone around me kind of said, you know, look, that doesn't make any sense at all. Let's start small. Let's do it right. Let's just have, you know, teams in and around Dallas. Over the years, we could grow and maybe we end up adding a Houston or a Little Rock or an Oklahoma City and just slowly but surely kind of branch out. And I was, I don't know, determined, for lack of a better word. Jen joined, and it I don't know, it caught fire in a really good way. I was speaking with Angela in Georgia not too long after that. She's in Columbus, Georgia. We started announcing teams in and around Rochester and Buffalo that saw that they were coming. Same thing happened in the Southeast with Georgia and in and around Texas from those initial teams that announced. And then I started talking with teams in the Northwest and the Southwest. And long story short, between December of 2020 and March of 2021, we had added 54 teams nationwide.
And was that mostly driven by individuals finding out about what you were doing and then coming to you and saying, hey, I'm in such and such and I want to start a franchise? Or was that more of you targeting, after you had maybe one franchise in a particular area, you targeting those markets and going out more actively seeking people? What was that process?
Great question. Yeah, a little bit of both. So the PBA, this is a little bit of a touchy conversation in some circles, and it really shouldn't be. We've all seen, you know, the Pepsi commercial that's the blind taste test challenge between Pepsi and Coke. And, you know, the person standing there at the table takes a sip from both cups and tells the camera about, you know, which one that they like better. I mean, that's common. This is business, right? It's not personal, but I just preface that, or, you know, want to preface what I say next by saying that. And, you know, we've uniquely positioned ourselves in a place where you've got many leagues, ABA, OBA, UBA, TBA, ECBL, PBL. There's, yeah, I don't know, a dozen minor leagues that don't do the things that we've been talking about. You know, for whatever reason, not disparaging them, you know, I'm asking the listener, go to their league website and double check what I'm saying. But they don't do all the things that we think is kind of a baseline of, and maybe I'm getting off topic, but I think I need to make the point. If we're talking about a single A baseball team in some town in Iowa that you've never even heard of before, is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to go to the league website for that minor league baseball team and be able to see every game that they've played, who, you know, how many at bats he got, how many home runs he hit, what his batting average was, who the pitchers were on the other team that he did it against, you know, rosters, standings, things that you would just think, even at the lowest possible level at minor league baseball, of course they have that, you know. And unfortunately, 99% of the leagues below us haven't figured that out. And some of them have had a couple decades to do it. And then on the other end of the spectrum, a league called the TBL, not disparaging them, you know, good guys, they work hard to do it right, but they've financially put themselves at a price point that's not cost conducive, makes it really difficult for teams to be able to show a profit. The inherent expenses that it takes to play in that league, not only by way of league franchise fees, but also the travel schedule and salaries and different commitments that they have as to being a member of that league, is very, very difficult for a minor league team to have enough revenue to be able to support that model. And we just didn't think that, you know, fundamentally that worked. And so what we've done is positioned the PBA in a place where we're giving these players and coaches an opportunity to play at the next level at an aggressive price point that is cost conducive, that does allow for profitability immediately for teams, that is an offering that's very different than all the leagues, you know, below us, but still at a place where, you know, teams and organizations can grow and be profitable and grow a fan base and add sponsors, and the business model aspect of it works financially for the clubs too. And so kind of being uniquely positioned in the middle of all that is, I think, what was the catalyst to, you know, growing as fast as we did and going nationwide and now being in the position that we're in today.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. Do you think that one of the most attractive points for you being able to get franchises in the door and get team owners in the door is what you're doing? Because what I hear you saying, and what would attract me, I think, is the fact that you're doing a lot of things, it sounds like, from a centralized point of view with your league, as opposed to some of the things that you're doing on a league-wide basis in other leagues may be things that the team, if they wanted to offer it, would have to pay for and do themselves, which then means some teams are doing it, some teams are not doing it. And so it sounds like the uniformity of kind of maybe taking it to the league-wide level as opposed to a team-by-team basis, that's one of the things it sounds like to me is going to be enabling you to attract more teams, more team owners.
Bingo. Yeah, you just hit the nail on the head exactly, Mike. And, you know, I think it all speaks to the motivation, and I won't single out a league in this part of it because I can't, you know, get into their hearts and minds and know what they're motivated by. But just a general commentary about the industry is that you have those leagues that are just interested in adding as many teams as they possibly can. And, you know, if they want 150, 200 minor league teams nationwide, and just, you know, it's all driven by revenue, that, you know, money is what drives the entire conversation, then from a sales process, you want to eliminate as many rules and regulations and stipulations and things that we think of in a positive way as organization could be seen as additional cost or additional responsibilities on the flip side of that coin. And so most of those leagues have, you know, taken the tact that, you know, hey, let's give a broad infrastructure with a lot of room for individuality. And unfortunately, what happens is, you know, you got, you know, 200 cooks in the kitchen and they're all bumping into each other and the, you know, spaghetti's getting spilled all over the formica, you know. So, we just took a different strategy that, no, this is what is required. This is the minimum. If you're not interested in your players having, you know, detailed statistics and getting jobs overseas and full game video and having all of your games televised, if those aren't, you know, things that are important to you, then, and you just want to play, you know, let's just hoop. Then there's lots of other leagues like that for you. I hope that answers your question.
No, it does. When you look at what you've been able to do to this point and you think about the various teams and franchises that you've been able to bring on board, what have been some of the shared characteristics of those that have been successful? And I guess you can define successful however you want, whether that's business-wise or on the floor. Just what are some characteristics of the team ownership and the teams that you've brought on that you feel have made them the most successful?
Yeah, I think, you know, getting out in the community is huge. The thing that I learned from, you know, a long time overseas is, you know, I'd go to these different countries and, you know, we were the NBA in that town. And, you know, so, you know, people that were interested in getting out in the community, people that, you know, had, you know, civic engagement, that, you know, partnered with the mayor, that would have, you know, things at the schools, that would have kids camps and clinics, that would be out, you know, at the recreation centers and the YMCAs, and, you know, working to, you know, with at-risk youth, a Big Brother program, just trying to be a community resource. It accomplished a lot of different things. I mean, one, obviously, you know, uplifting, or, you know, working to uplift the community that you serve in, I think just kind of speaks to my heart and, you know, one of the things that we'd like to accomplish with the PBA. But obviously the other aspect of it is, you know, the relationships that you make and exposing people to your brand and to your program and growing an organization, building a fan base, you know, adding sponsors, that, you know, those things are all critical to being in this. And, you know, there's a couple different models about, you know, what we think works in the United States of America and how some of that, you know, adapts here domestically. Spent a lot of time in Canada that they played in NHL hockey arenas and, you know, several, you know, civic auditoriums and large, you know, 10 to 16,000 seat facilities. And, you know, the NBA really, you know, other than, you know, the Toronto Raptors, which is just, you know, one city in a country that's larger than ours, didn't have, you know, competing leagues. Also, you know, a lot of great colleges and universities in Canada. This isn't meant to a slight to them, but, you know, right, they didn't have UCLA in their backyard. You know, University of Texas isn't, you know, located in some of these cities up north. And so I just kind of draw and contrast, you know, where the United States is a different kind of beast, right? We've got so many things and access to so many entertainment options. I mean, just think about, you know, pro basketball, Major League Baseball, Minor League Baseball, pro hockey, Minor League Hockey, you know, all the different sports and all the different entertainment options and things that we do, that, you know, every city in America has so many competing options. Major Division I college basketball that, you know, have been around for 100 years and have an extremely loyal fan base that, you know, goes to every game, and you know, even high school sports. High school football in Texas is huge, but high school sports for basketball and baseball around the country are big as well. And so I say all that to say that, you know, at the minor league level in the United States, putting together a formula or a requirement of teams, a price point, if you will, of what it takes for an organization here has to be supported by the revenue that you have the potential to be able to acquire in each individual market. The NBA G League published statistics last year, and this is a league that's supported by the NBA, that has NBA players moving up and down, that has high draft picks, players that are, you know, recovering maybe from injury, that are NBA established stars in some instances, playing on these NBA G League teams, yet you'll see them moving to facilities like the health facility, UCLA health facility that the Lakers G League franchise plays at, seats 1,000 people. They've gone over the years more and more away from the giant civic auditoriums and NBA sized arenas to smaller facilities. The average attendance is something, what's published is something just over 2,000 fans. Now, how much of that is actually paid attendance and how much of it is, comps and giveaways and corporate deals and different things to be able to get butts in seats for their sponsors. But I think, and don't quote me, I don't want to, you know, disparage the NBA by any stretch, but If the G League is struggling in a lot of cities to get, you know, 1,200 to 1,500 people out to a NBA G League game, and they've got, you know, established NBA players in many instances playing on those teams, and the marketing muscle and wherewithal of the NBA behind them driving those franchises in those markets, and they can't consistently average that attendance, then how could a structure that is at the price point that some leagues are, that would require that by way of attendance in order for them to be financially viable, work? And the fact of the matter is it doesn't. There's a large number of teams that are, defaulting on loans and responsibilities, player contracts, coaching payments, you know, things like that, it's because it's a model that just doesn't work. And so what the PBA has done is make ourselves with scalability and being smart about, you know, how we do it. And everyone is, you know, in large part investing a tremendous amount of time and doing so in many instances in a volunteer basis and or, you know, smaller salaries. We've been lean and mean and put together a program where we're price point competitive with, you know, all those leagues below us that don't do any of the things that we do. And so I'll give you an example. A franchise in the PBA is $19.95, so less than $2,000. It's a one-time cost for to bring, you know, pro basketball to your city. That franchise fee is paid once, and they return every season at no charge. And then the game fees are less than $250 a game, include the referees, the video editing, the play-by-play guy, the statisticians, the writers, a graphics artist that three times a week does promotional material. We've got a huge social media following. We had 1.1 million viewers on PBA TV last season. And to be able to, the part I'm proudest about is to be able to do all of that at, you know, hey, less than $250 a game, right? Like, this is something that any organization, whether it was an AAU program that wanted to, hey, what do I do with these kids once they're done with the, you know, 18 and unders, these guys that want to come back to my program, the high school coach, the junior college coach, the other minor league organizations across the United States that have some of the same frustrations that I do. How come I can't see the rosters of the team that I'm supposed to play? How come I don't have a season schedule on the league website? How come I can't find all the games that the team I'm about to play has played online? And where are the stats for everyone else in my league? And why can't I get my guys signed overseas? I think there's so many people involved in basketball at every level that could afford to have, you know, minor league basketball in their city and have it at a price point that is conducive with them being profitable, even with a small fan base and a couple tryouts. It's very easy to turn a profit year one in the PBA. And so I just think we're uniquely positioned in the market to, you know, become the top minor league basketball in America.
So is the main revenue source for teams their local ticket sales?
Yeah, ticket sales and sponsors, those are the big two. Yeah.
So when you have most of those local sponsorships, right, are then those are the responsibility of the local team owner. Now you might get involved and be able to help them and give them a script or give them some talking points. But I'm assuming then the team owners, again, the more ambitious you are to go out and talk to people in the community like you talked about, obviously that's going to help your ticket sales, but also can obviously help your ability to attract sponsors, which is going to fall right directly to your bottom line.
Yeah. And the nice part is that, you know, like I stated earlier, even with a really, you know, smaller fan base, you know, if quick math, you know, less than $250 a game, plus the cost of your venue, a table staff, what you do for your players and coaches, you know, a videographer, a team can put together a presentation for their home fans, traveling expenses, because the other teams in their division are all drivable. We've got it set up so there's no flights. Hotels are optional. A lot of teams can drive play and drive back, kind of more like the minor league baseball model. So we've got the whole thing set up lean and mean, you know, like I said earlier, but even, you know, something as small as, you know, 100 to 150 fans a game is something where you start breaking even real quickly. And then as you add to that, as the organization grows and you add local sponsorship and businesses that want to get their message out to, you know, that ever increasing fan base over time. But the league also helps with that process. So we've got commercials that play during these televised games. I told you over a million viewers last season. And so the commercials that play during the games are spots that 30 second spots that the teams can sell to local sponsors in their area. So, hey, let me get you on Roku. Let me get you on Amazon. You know, I'm going to play your commercial twice during every game. I'm going to have your banner in my gym. I'm going to put your logo on our uniforms. I'm going to put you out there with all of our social media marketing. We're in the community. We're getting the brand message out there. And even just really small sponsorships can, you know, the whole thing is conducive to the owner being able to cover all the responsibilities. And I think this is maybe the most important point in the whole thing. Keep their commitments contractually to what they promise to players and coaches. You know, don't burn the people that help us put this product out on the floor. And the way you do that is just by being a little smarter with the business part of it.
All right, let's shift to the player side of it. From a player perspective, one, where are most of the players, I'm assuming, are players who are local to the community where the franchise is located. But let's just say once you have a franchise, how do you go about attracting players? Open tryouts? Are you putting the word out? How do you get the word out that, hey, we're new in town and we're looking for players? What does that look like?
Yeah. So when a team is announced, typically within 2 or 3 weeks of an expansion team, you know, joining the league, they'll post about a tryout. We've got a following on Instagram of over 30,000, and on Facebook we share to about 150 basketball specific groups nationwide. A lot of them are kind of key markets, and then we also have an advertising spend on social media to help teams get the word out. In we have a set kind of proprietary algorithm, if you will, of search terms that we use in communities that kind of drill down to who our core market audience is. And it's a combination of all those things. You know, when I was, I'm 50 years old, and so I'm not that old, but when I was a kid, we would print flyers and we would staple them to the telephone poles, you know, like
yep.
Word of mouth. We would go to the gym and just start passing out, you know, pamphlets. That was the way of the world. You know, I'm talking 80s, 90s. But obviously with the internet revolution and social media and everyone's staring at their phones all day, every day now, that we're able to, you know, leverage the technology. 1891 is a big partner with us in this, that, you know, we're able to get that message out. And players are looking for an opportunity to get to the next level. Not everybody, you know, averaged 15 points per game at Duke, you know, and they need that platform to be able to stand on and let the rest of the world know who they are and what they're capable of doing and what their contributions could be overseas. And, you know, the PBA's mission is to help as many players and coaches as possible to get to the next level. And I think the players and coaches see that in our advertising and the things that we're doing on social media and how much coverage we give to our existing players. They've downloaded the app. There are a lot of those 1.1 million viewers on PBA TV that are watching these games on their big screen TV, hearing, you know, Mike Cooper, you know, from three, and you hear Mike's name 20 times on TV, and it's kind of just human nature. Hey, that could be me. And so they see what we're doing and, you know, want to come out and be a part of it.
What about from a coaching perspective? Where do most of your coaches, what's their backgrounds?
Yeah, so broad backgrounds like me. A lot of them, you know, came from AAU or high school basketball or junior college, and you know, I loved working with the kids, and that was a real enjoyable part in my coaching career. But there are some that, you know, just are burnt out, whether it's the parents or, you know, the politics or, you know, whatever's going on. But even for those that have AAU programs with their organization, have multiple age groups, have, you know, maybe both genders and several different teams, that, you know, those people that run those organizations like the idea of having that, you know, top team of their organization because they have a built-in fan base. All those players and parents that are part of those youth groups all want to participate with the minor league team. So they, day one, when they announce a team, already have all of those kids and all of their family members that, you know, hey, you know, these are the players that come to my, you know, practices and have, you know, signed basketballs and passed out t-shirts, and I want to go support them, and we give out free tickets and do things to, you know, encourage them to come out to the games nationwide. And so yeah, I hope that answers your question.
No, it does. What's your favorite team name?
Favorite team name? Ooh, that's a good one. You know, I grew up in LA, so I'm gonna say the Lakers, but I'm biased. I don't know that intrinsically that's the best team name, but they're my favorite team.
There's some good ones. What about in the PBA? What's your most, what nickname when it came on, you're like, ooh, that's a good one?
I really like the PNW Vets. So organization that the ownership group all come from a military background. And I love the idea of the civic aspect of that, community engagement, you know, people that have served. I talked earlier about Angela and kind of the core values that you get in the military for those people that served. Thank you for your service. So I love that. Their uniforms are fire. They look a little bit like the Utah Jazz with the mountains, white with blue, and it says Vets across the chest. Those are really cool looking. The Vipers is a great one. It's a, you know, obviously a viper that's on the chest, that's the logo. They're purple with black, and those are really, that's a cool team name too.
Do you have a success story from one of the players that's played in the PBA that you've been able to help and move forward in their career that you can share with our audience?
Oh my God. Yeah. There's so many guys, and this is why we do this, right? It's that guy that took advantage of the opportunity and played for his team and, you know, put up the stats and had his games televised and then, got the overseas opportunity. So there's so many players like that. One guy that kind of sticks out to me that, is a really good guy, had some overseas experience before, but a guy by the name of Mike Liebo. Mike is was referred to me by Ricky Benitez. He lives in Florida, had played in Latin America, and I want to say he had been away from playing overseas for a couple of years, but really talented, 6'5", left-handed, can shoot it, handles like a point guard. Rebounds well, just kind of a multi-positional athlete that, you know, we went through COVID and we had, you know, so there are gap years is what they call them resume wise for players that may make it difficult and going back to an overseas opportunity. And so the PBA was the perfect vehicle for him to come on and, you know, show that he was in shape and that he was still the level and capable of helping a team. And so Mike got a contract and went down to South America and is, you know, has been playing, resumed his overseas playing career. I don't want to take credit for it. You know, he's the one that put in the work and made the sacrifices to make that happen. But I'd like to think that, you know, getting his name out there and helping to provide that platform was something that he was able to utilize to stand up on it and open doors. And that's what minor league basketball is all about.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think one of the themes that's kind of run through the podcast over the years has been just the ability to use basketball, something that we all love, to be able to impact people, whether that's through coaching them directly, whether that's through you getting this league started and helping players to realize their dreams. I think that's really what it's all about when you think about the opportunity to use something that you love to be able to have an impact on people. That's really where the sweet spot is in the game of basketball. No matter what role you're playing in the game, I think we all love being able to utilize the game to make people's lives better and to help grow the game. And that's really what it's all about. When you look ahead, Chris, to the future of the PBA over the next couple of years, what do you envision? What do you hope? What's the ideal model for what you see this becoming in another couple of years as you continue to build it out?
Yeah, so we partnered with 1891, and so the PBA is now known as the PBA by 1891. And, you know, Curtis and I talked about him earlier, finished each other's sentences. And so he's got a great tech staff behind him, and a lot of what we're able to do is technically driven. So, you know, we saw the advantage for both of us to partner in this effort. More from, a tech standpoint. Curtis also brings that organizational and, you know, leadership aspects, with his relationship with Chick-fil-A, just speaking to uniformity and scalability and teams upholding a certain standard. So to answer your question, we instituted something where $100,000 will be paid out by way of prize monies to the top PBA teams over the next 2 years. So that's one deal we put together with 1891 to be able to offer that. It's something that in nationwide minor league basketball currently doesn't exist that I know of. So it was something extra, you know, kind of icing on the cake, if you will, for what we could offer to teams. And then we're brokering a deal so that our merchandise and several of our teams have already worked to do this, where their merchandise is in Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Publix, different chains across the United States, so that our merchandise is in the communities that we're in and readily available, you know, in the retail market. And then we're currently working with a national sponsor. So this is the part where I'm looking into the future a little bit, and I yet to be named, but a large national sponsor that is looking to partner with us in a big way that will help us take the whole thing to another level. And kind of like Chick-fil-A, I'll use this as a comparison. When people look to run a Chick-fil-A franchise, there's no risk. They already have a built-in formula where you know that you're going to be profitable. And so they're very selective about what bring into their model, what, you know, people they partner with to run their franchises, because there's a long waiting list. And what they ask for in order to start a franchise with them is considerably less than even just their first year's earnings. So they have a proven model of success that allows Chick-fil-A to be very selective about who they bring in. And we love that model. We want to be able to offer something to teams that what they get from the league is has 10 times more value than what the cost to participate in it is. And because of that, that gives us a long list of franchise owners that are interested in joining, and we can put together a professional league that everyone can be proud of.
That's awesome. I think that vision is one that is definitely within reach based on what you've been able to do to this point. I think it's exciting for minor league basketball here in the United States that somebody who has the vision that you've been able to have and put together is going to give lots and lots of players, communities, coaches, the opportunity to participate in a league that's professionally run and that has some of the innovations and things that you've been able to put together. Before we wrap up, Chris, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about the PBA, Amazon Fire and Roku. Just go through all that, where people can find out more about the PBA.
Yeah, so Roku, Amazon Fire, iOS and Android at your app store. So, you know, from your TV using the search menu or at your app store, It's just five letters, PBATV. So it's an acronym, Pro Basketball Association. So PBATV. Just search that however you want to stream, and you'll find us on there. On Instagram, we're at PBA by 1891. So all spelled together. PBA by 1891 at Instagram. And we're at Pro Basketball Association on Facebook. And then the league website is www.pbaplayers.com.
Chris, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on and talk about the PBA. It's an exciting venture that I know you're very proud of. I can hear that in your voice, and I think you got a great thing going, and I wish you nothing but success as you and your team move forward with the PBA. And to everyone out there who's a part of our audience, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.